honestly, a lot of it is listening, recognizing the commonalities, recognizing that we can't just keep existing without measuring our progress and our efficacy, and that we have to wise up, and that DevOps does blend her expertise.
Hi, you're listening to The Secure Developer. It is part of the My DevSecOps community, which also includes the upcoming free DevSecOn 24 virtual conference. With great speakers intersecting the dev and security worlds, it's not to be missed. Sign up at devsecon.com. This podcast is sponsored by Sneak. Sneak is a dev-first security company helping companies fix vulnerabilities in open source components and containers without slowing down development. To learn more, visit sneak.io. On today's episode, Guy Pajani, president and co-founder of Sneak, talks to Kelly Shortridge. Kelly is currently VP of Product Strategy at Capsule 8, following product roles at Security Scorecard and BAE Systems Applied Intelligence, as well as co-founding Impalane, a security startup which was acquired. Kelly is also known for her presenting at technology conferences internationally on topics ranging from behavioral economics of InfoSec to chaos security engineering.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Secure Developer. Today, we have with us a guest that I've been sort of chasing for a while now. Really excited to have her on the show. We have Kelly Shortridge with us. She's the VP Product Management and Strategy at Capsule 8, and also a really kind of brilliant analyst, I think, of the security industry. So welcome to the show, Kelly. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. That's very kind praise.
Just sort of say it like you see it there. You know, I think I really love your writing. So I guess, you know, as we dig into it, before we're going to explore a bunch of these things you've written about, want to dig into, tell us a bit about, you know, what is it you do and how you got into security in the first place?
Yeah, my background is a little strange for the security industry. I actually started out my career in investment banking. So I was an M&A banker covering information security as well as data analytics. And with the overconfidence of youth, I decided to start my own startup straight after being an investment banking analyst and founded a startup that later was acquired by one of the very big security companies today. And then from there, I pursued product roles at BAE Systems Applied Intelligence, Security Scorecard, and now I'm VP at Capsule 8.
Very cool. And what does it mean, kind of, you know, running product management and strategy?
Yeah, nobody knows what it means, but it gets people going, right? So I think product strategy is especially nebulous, but I think it's ultimately about understanding the market and understanding user and customer problems in a way that helps you prioritize how you need to build the product, like what features are going to matter, and also how to communicate the problem to the market and how you can kind of level up the community and understanding kind of like tangential problem areas.
And you've been, just again, a little bit of context maybe for the listeners is, can you tell us a little bit about some of the Capsule 8, and I know before you were at Security Scorecard, just to sort of understand a bit of context where you were working more deeply on one security problem or the other.
Yeah, they're very disparate problems. So Security Scorecard deals with third-party risk management. So producing, you know, the famous like letter grades based on open source kind of analysis of different security metrics. And then Capsule 8 does enterprise Linux infrastructure protection. So detection and resilience, including things like automated response. It's very different ends of the security spectrum. One's more like compliance. The other is like, you know, more of this modern sort of protection looking ahead into the future. So it's been really interesting to see kind of the difference between the different user and buyer personas and how people think about kind of those problem areas differently. And both have slightly played into the research that I do somewhat accidentally on in my spare time. So looking at things like the behavioral economics of InfoSec, looking at just how we communicate different InfoSec concepts. Like you can see how some of my day job is driven by what I pursue, you know, on nights and weekends.
Yeah. And I guess that's a good sort of tee up maybe for starting a conversation a bit about DevOps. So, you know, you're talking about working with the sort of advanced protection of Linux systems. And I must imagine that really traverses the worlds of ops and sort of infrastructure. And you've written a fair bit about sort of that intersection of DevOps and security. So I guess, how do you see those two worlds? Like, we're going to explore how we see those two worlds kind of interact, but at a high level, like, how do you see those two worlds? Are they getting closer? Are they getting further apart? How do you see the interaction between those two coming?
Yeah, the way I like to characterize them today is they're frenemies. You know, there's kind of a deep-seated dislike between the two groups, but they kind of know that they have to deal with each other, which is not a particularly healthy dynamic. I think it's inevitable that they're going to have to partner more, and ideally it would not be an antagonistic relationship, which is some of what I've discussed. But I think ultimately what we're going to see kind of as we see, I mean, especially now the acceleration of like the fabled digital transformation timelines is a lot of the goals are similar. And frankly, if InfoSec doesn't have some of the same goals as DevOps, which are largely like how to ensure that operations stay stable and performant in order to enable the business and help it make money, it's kind of a basic thing, right? So if InfoSec's against that, the question is, what is InfoSec for, and can that survive as technology is increasingly the driver of, or the most direct driver of revenue for companies?
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. Do you think, I love the sort of the definition of sort of frenemies for it. Do you think that changed? Like, do you think it was it at any point like sort of ops and security versus dev, and now it's sort of security versus dev and ops?
It's a good question. I feel like security and dev, it's been increasingly fraught relationship. I think if we go way back, both was covered by, you know, the sysadmin label back in like the 90s. So yeah. It's been interesting how they've kind of like deviated from each other. I think probably what exacerbated things is it used to almost be like this horrible frenemy triangle of like ops, dev, and security, where they all kind of disliked each other. But now that dev and ops has more of an alliance and they're more collaborative, maybe now security's feeling extra threatened. I'm not totally sure on the reason, but it does seem like tensions are very high.
Yeah, well, and I guess, you know, I relate to this being a challenge, and also, of course, that this kind of must be solved, right, for us to progress. Let's walk down that lane a little bit of sort of the DevOps and security themes. You're a bit of a fan of controversial titles, but you know, one of your writings, you know, not long ago was around container security. And the article was titled saying, you know, that it's cool, but nobody knows what it means. So that really begs the question of what does container security mean?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I think it means different things to different people, which is part of my struggle with the label. But I think ultimately it's about ensuring containerized environments are resilient to security failure. And I think that can take a few different forms. It can obviously take the form of like, we need to make sure that the images being used don't have any particularly bad like vulnerabilities in them. It can be more like what Capsulate does, where we're trying to make sure like as containers are running, they're not being compromised, like when they're providing services out in production. But I think ultimately, if you anchor it to that, like, okay, these containers need to be resilient to security failure, I think that's a great grounding principle. And I think also eliminates a lot of the very strange definitions or products people try to tie to it.
Is it like, I understand the high level statement, but is there a risk of it being too broad? Like basically the resistance of X to security failures is pretty broad statement, no? Like would you sort of be able to say mobile device, you'd be able to say VM, you'd be able to say desktop. Is that not the case? Or like, is there something that you'd still say is different about container security versus just any endpoint security?
Yeah, I think there are definitely differences. One is that there's a much lower tolerance by, again, more of the ops team in what kind of failure can manifest. So I think they're in some ways more tolerant of security failure than they are of performance failure. So certainly on the endpoint side, some of the things that can work on laptops, like I think everyone, including myself, has experienced, you know, antivirus programs mandated by your employer, like freezing up your laptop, and it's a huge pain. But the ops team is maybe going to strangle the security team if one of the security tools does that in production, right? And I think it's kind of similar, even if we look, and this is not a paid pitch just for your company, but I think if we look also on the kind of the vulnerability scanning side of containers as well, I think it's important to acknowledge that the key difference is like you're not having to scan across a bunch of really disparate sort of monoliths. Ideally, you have some sort of base image and image repository full of those base images that have been very well vetted. And I think that's maybe a nuanced difference between the old paradigm and application security, but I think it's an important one. And I think crucially, we need to start having people think about containers and VMs in different ways because that maybe is where we need more specificity, because I get very tired of people conflating the two and thinking then that the security needs are the same. So I definitely think like resilient to security failure, right? That's a very broad thing. I also think if anything, the container security label has been too narrow, mostly around vulnerability scanning, and specifically scanning like code repositories, sometimes like CI/CD pipelines. But there's definitely a risk of it being too broad and people think they can just copy paste what's worked, like you said, mobile or laptops over to containers and ops will kill them.
Yeah. No, interesting. So makes a lot of sense. So basically like one aspect of it, which I imagine containers kind of share with other servers, is, you know, you have to think about them in a different way to sort of patch management of a desktop because of sort of tolerance and also maybe the willingness you're saying that the performance overhead you're allowed, or sort of, you know, whatever error tolerance in containers is lower. Do you perceive that it's lower than VMs as well? Do you think the sensitivity to performance, I get the delta between, you know, your desktop or sort of your laptop and the server, but do you think there's also a delta between like container performance overhead tolerance versus like a VM or a bare metal machine?
I think there's a slightly bigger one. I mean, I think for one, going back to your point about the rate, just the general kind of performance tolerance of containers, they make money, and that's a key difference between it and just like standard endpoints. But I think as far as VMs and vanilla sort of bare metal servers, the key difference with containers, I think, is there's been this, it's almost like conceptual shift in the way that companies operate. And I don't think you necessarily have to have containers to do this. You can potentially use VMs. There's just a much higher expectation for uptime at this point. And I do think realistically that containers enable a lot of that like scalability and just frankly, the modularity they allow just enables a lot more speed. So if you have this crazy intense speed from the, you know, 2002 perspective, again, no ops team is going to be willing to sacrifice uptime at this point with some sort of security tool. And I think more than changing that dynamic, containers just like solidified it. I think it was still there before, but now it's zero tolerance. And I think there are also slightly technical things where like containers are sharing like host resources, VMs, like you still have the resource stack controls. There are nuances there as well.
Yeah, of course, the technology stack itself. Okay, so it makes sense. I mean, we're sort of unraveling all sorts of challenges with container security. First of all, they're like maybe most tactically, they're a technical difference. They are probably sensitivity. And this is like, I love that insight into sort of a DevOps practices. If you're using containers, you're probably much more mindful of sort of uptime, boot time, all of those elements. So the bar for a security tool is higher. And then you sort of have those development practices of like how, who's kind of dictating what's inside the container and all of that, which again requires slightly different than the controls and the VMs. If all of that wasn't hard enough, you know, containers that oftentimes kind of live in the microservice environment. So maybe is it the same to say container security and to say microservice security? What are your thoughts about microservices security?
So I actually published an article very recently about this. I think as far as what security needs to understand, I think thinking about microservices as containers and APIs is a good enough simplification. I don't think microservices directly equals containers. Obviously, containers are a key component for the most part. I would say in general, between the two, as we've discussed, the industry level of understanding on containers is still pretty poor, especially threat modeling them. And I actually think there's an opportunity for microservices architecture in general to be better understood, particularly by kind of the veterans of the InfoSec industry, because they were probably around for the service-oriented architecture days. And frankly, like microservices and SOA are conceptually similar. So I don't think it's too much of a leap. It's just what I've found, like I talked about in the blog post, there's still like a huge fear around it. And it's kind of strange because SOA didn't cause, I mean, I wasn't there, to be perfectly honest, so maybe it did. But from what I can glean, SOA didn't cause quite the same level of panic, and I'm not totally sure why. But what I've kind of found is it seems like for a lot of the InfoSec industry, and obviously not everyone, I think they still are thinking in that kind of like on-prem monolith model, and they think that basically microservices just copying, pasting monoliths with all of those equivalent challenges over 1,000 instances and then making them public. And through that lens, like it makes sense why you would panic, but that's not really what the reality is. And that's not really the threat model or how it works. That's one of the challenges. And I certainly think there are also overlooked benefits as far as microservices too.
Overlooked benefits to security?
Oh yeah, definitely. So like standardization, for example, security could be partnering with their engineering colleagues to ensure like any new deployments adhere to a standard and make sure like the standardized APIs, images, whatever else are rigorously vetted. So basically, instead of having to conduct like a bunch of different security reviews on a ton of different resources and components, you can actually, as a security team, like streamline your work to really just ensure like the base image or design is solid. And you would think that security would love the idea of less work, but again, I don't know if it's lack of awareness or what, or lack of control. I'm not sure what it is, but I think standardization is one of the key things in microservices that anything makes security's job easier. And I would argue that a lot of the complexity that's added with microservices architecture, because obviously it does have downsides, is much worse on the engineering and performance side than it is on the security side.
So interesting. So I guess maybe let's dig a little bit into these benefits. You know, I like to find those kind of opportunities, maybe the positive gems in there. So like one is standardization. So these services run in a consistent way because they're deployed in a consistent way. They're sort of managed in a consistent way. So you have that standardized. I guess, is it fair to say that also they communicate via better defined APIs?
Exactly.
So you have like a more defined scope. So one of the challenges that I'm often puzzled by when think about microservices is really kind of what's the whole. I mean, what have you seen for sort of best practices around saying, well, I've got like these 20 microservices, you know, not to say 2,000, and a single request or a single kind of action in my system might traverse some number of those until it sort of completes and gets back to the client or not. What's the threat model approach, or like how would you tackle understanding what's the whole, you know, like what's the complete view to be able to sort of ascertain if it's secure, right? If you didn't just let three systems that work well independently just sort of expose something when it's in between.
Yeah, so I think that system level model is super important. I would argue also it's not that different than the prior paradigm of what we had to do. Where I'd argue it's better is that instead of having to tease apart like a monolith and figure out like, okay, this is where we identify like this business logic. Okay, how does it connect to this? Like generally with microservices, you're going to have much better and very like tightly defined business logic that you can threat model very directly. You can even start to say like, okay, we have this like pattern and standard for, let's say, how you authenticate whatever. And the developers can basically just copy pasta that instead of building their own each time. So again, that kind of like modularization is a key component of it. I think also, again, like being able to threat model and see very distinctly, it's like a bite-sized chunk. Like, okay, we know that with this microservices, it's just talking to this other microservice that uses this exact data versus trying to, again, tease apart this kind of like a giant chunk and figure out like all the different components. It's actually much easier for the security team than it used to be. Again, I don't think the industry is really thinking of it that way. And it can be somewhat complex if you have to threat model literally every microservice, but there's some like you can start, I'm actually writing this in one of the upcoming books I'm writing, is that you can start to actually create much better kind of automated security workflows where you can, as a developer, kind of go through a checklist of like, okay, are we consuming sensitive customer data? Yes or no? And basically work down a list and figure out, does this microservice actually need a security review? Obviously, you have to have like good feedback loops to figure out whether that process was successful. If they end up having an incident, then those privileges get revoked as far as going through the checklist. You can actually offload a lot of the work that security does today on the development team using microservices because of that narrow scope each microservice has. It becomes much easier just to understand what the security implications are.
I love that approach. I mean, I think you really well neutralized the sort of concern I raised, which is, for starters, it was there all along. It was just in code instead of in microservices, except before you didn't have visibility to test each of these different components, and now you do. I guess there's probably like one scenario, but that's way down the list of what if one of the microservices was compromised and then that goes off and is now able to sort of reach others. But again, you would have had one part of the code that is compromised, and before you didn't have any isolation. Now you might have at least some.
Definitely. And I would argue that, again, with kind of the container plus API model, if you know exactly what the business logic should be, you can actually much more tightly allow list things in the APIs to be like, no, it can literally only talk to this one other service, which again, if you compromise the container in some way, you can laterally move and stuff like that. But ideally, that's when you have at least some form of monitoring, and then it gets into the DIE model I talked about in my security chaos engineering talk from Black Hat, where ideally you have the ability to just shut down the container if you have any sort of modification to the container itself. So if you use immutable containers, it becomes harder for the attackers to laterally move anyway. So again, it kind of opens up all these like cool and frankly like easier opportunities for security. Doesn't mean that there aren't downsides, obviously, but I think, again, like if anything, security benefits more in a weird way than operations sometimes.
Love the argument. I think you're making a really strong case for how microservices, you know, they seem scary because they change things, but fundamentally they actually kind of set you up better for security for it. So I want to kind of glom on a little bit to that sort of comment on chaos engineering. It's definitely one of my favorite practices, I think, in the world of DevOps, chaos engineering, shutting down systems without them being shut down on their own. In the ops world, I think it's one of the primary tools to be able to sort of deal with the unknown, right? It sort of introduces risk. It's even called attacks oftentimes, right, within these tools. Say it runs it. And you talk about how do you use chaos engineering for security. You just gave us a bit of a taste for it, but can you walk us through like how do we security test or sort of apply chaos engineering to security?
I think there are a ton of ways. And as I alluded to earlier, please do check out once it's available later this year. I am writing literally the book with Aaron Reinhart on security chaos engineering. So obviously I think it's an important topic. I think the key thing, it's, if anything, it's almost a philosophical shift that's necessary for security, which is embracing that failure is inevitable and that it can be really powerful. I think one of the problems we see in security is that feedback loops aren't embraced. In fact, a lot of times we shy away from feedback because, you know, if we know about an incident, like, then it's an incident, right? And if we view, and I think this is a huge problem in security in general, like if we view everything through the lens of, oh, a human caused this, a human did something wrong, then of course we're going to try to avoid feedback. And also other people won't try to give us feedback. Like, it's this horrible kind of paradigm we have today. And security chaos engineering, I view it as really freeing us from that paradigm. It says, you know what, failure is inevitable. It's okay. We just have to be prepared for it. And we have to be able to be resilient to it. And that doesn't just mean we can withstand attacks. It means we can withstand at least some of the attack and be able to minimize the impact. That's crucial. We can also adapt, though. We can kind of like reorganize systems around the threat. We can actually transform our systems over time based on that feedback to make sure that we're evolving at the same pace as attackers. Because I think probably most of the people who are listening would agree that defense is often a lot slower than attack at being able to evolve their methods and systems and technologies. And security chaos engineering basically says, like, nope, that's not how the world works. You need to ingest this feedback and learn from it and have this really kind of intellectually honest model where you embrace any information that failure gives you and just view it as a learning opportunity. There's no shame in it. Like, it happens to everyone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's kind of the principle there. Still, like, I'd love to sort of go, maybe, can you give us one or two examples of what is the type of attack that you would do? Like, chaos engineering, like, examples there on the DevOps side is like you shut down a service, right? Or you reduce the memory, right? Or you sever a network connection. What are the types of attacks or what chaos would you inflict under the mantle of chaos security engineering or security chaos engineering?
Yeah, definitely. This is definitely the fun stuff. And there's a ton of stuff you can do here, a variety of levels. So some of the examples talked about before and some of my favorite ones is, for instance, going back to containers. Like, if you make your container immutable, all you have to do is inject attempts to SSH into the container and then write to disk. And ideally, it should crash the container. But that's a good example of, like, how does the container react? You can also do things with APIs. Like, you can revoke tokens and then try to reuse old tokens to see where they're accepted throughout your service or your general system. You can actually adopt a lot of some of the tests that you mentioned on the availability side, because that's where a lot of operations is focused, because uptime is paramount on that side. So you can do lots of cool things. Like, I would argue that some of the stuff like Netflix has done makes them incredibly resilient to DDoS attacks, which is obviously a security thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you're testing, like, whether to what extent you shutting down a bunch of your systems and, like, injecting failure to a bunch of your nodes at random affects your service delivery, like, that's makes you incredibly resilient against any sort of DDoS. So I think that's a great way to start on the network side. There are even things where if you have an automation server like Jenkins, sometimes you can, they generally have some sort of console script. Like, can you access that with, like, an anonymous user? Can you create an anonymous user in the first place? Like, there are lots of things where you can just inject various failures depending, obviously, on your threat model and your priorities, and just see how the system responds, which obviously requires a certain level of visibility and telemetry collection. You should probably already be collecting that anyway.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to the commentary on microservices and their APIs, right? Because you can basically build those types of kind of chaos tests for any given microservice and then see how the overall system responds, right? When one of them fails, sort of see how the relation is. Yeah, definitely love the concept, you know, and I guess I've always been a fan of chaos engineering, so would be even more so when security starts embracing it, and definitely looking forward to that book coming out.
Yeah, it'll make security fun, right?
Yeah, indeed. So I guess we're traversing down this sort of DevOps narratives, and I guess we sort of naturally ended up sort of talking about technology, and then we talked about sort of practices like microservices and chaos engineering. Great observations there. Probably a good place to land now is people. So in the world of ops, you know, many sort of would sort of say that DevOps is really first and foremost a cultural revolution, sort of, you know, a people revolution, and then that drives these processes and technology. One of the primary roles that's been discussed is, or that came to be, is this SRE, right? The sort of service reliability engineer that is an engineer that replaces maybe that sort of past sysadmin, you know, is kind of helping developers keep a system up, while maybe as opposed to someone who maybe have kept those systems up themselves. What do you think? Do you think that's something that will happen in the world of security as well? Like, if you think about this security SRE or the likes, is that a role that makes sense? What do you think will happen to sort of job descriptions and or job scopes in security as this type of security DevOps approaches get embraced?
That's a fantastic question, and I do not have a crystal ball, so any listeners take this with a grain of salt, but I think ultimately what we'll see is that the security role takes on a form more akin to like advisory and subject matter expertise, where if you assume that just like dev and ops ended up merging because you can't have accountability separate from responsibility, otherwise you have all these moral hazard issues, kind of need to see the same thing on the security side, which means that security has to lend their expertise to different product and development teams, but they shouldn't really be the ones fixing things, and they shouldn't be the ones actually implementing things. They should be helping threat model and thinking about from the very beginning, starting with design, how can we build things more securely. I think it's actually really positive that we would move away from the security engineer who just manages the blinky boxes more to someone who is frankly more strategic in nature and has to be an expert on a variety of things. For some people, that's really exciting. For others, obviously, that's not necessarily a very strong suit. So I think we're going to see more of, again, that kind of like advisory role. I also think SRE could end up merging a little bit with security, just because if you look at incident response processes and how they're conducted, they largely overlap between what SREs will do or just generally on the ops side and what security does. And a lot of times the security team has to go like tag the SRE anyway during an incident because the SRE is the one managing a piece of infrastructure that may have been compromised. So I think we're going to start to see a lot more blending of that role, just frankly out of efficiency and because it's hard for a security person to like properly investigate and respond to an incident in technology from which they're like really removed. So this all goes back to like a certain point. Maybe we're just going to go back to like the sysadmin label and we'll be back in, you know, the late 90s.
Yeah, I guess to an extent, I like the full circle because it does imply more of a merging. And I guess there's a lot of comments on DevSecOps is really just DevOps, you know, and it should DevOps done right, right? And sort of embedding security into it. But I do think, as you point out, that the security industry itself and kind of the role that people there take need to change. If I can kind of maybe take you up a level a little bit, because I know in your, you know, a lot of your work, whether it's Encapsulate or it's kind of, you know, past roles, is maybe a little bit closer to a bunch of these activities. But the other thing that you do is you do survey the industry as a whole, and you have this sort of great newsletter. What do you think, you know, a bunch of these practices are or changes happen at, well, I guess you've mentioned some that are industry-wide and some that are inside an organization. How do you think we're adapting to this as an industry, to this change? Like, are we doing a good job or are you doing a bad job? What changes would you foresee happening in the industry?
I think we're doing a bad job. I think in general, vendors in security do quite a bad job serving the practitioners. I would argue that a lot of the practitioners are also not thinking quite as, again, intellectually honestly as they could be. I think part of that is frankly, like we don't benefit particularly much from this merging in the sense that, you know, right now we're kind of our own fiefdom and that gets eroded. We'd still be equally as important as far as priority. In fact, potentially more important because if we're seen as enabling the business, we might receive bigger budget. The thing is we won't be in that silo anymore. And so we'll be more in like a republic rather than that fiefdom. And I can understand why a few people would be upset about that. The other thing is like in DevOps, everything's measured. You can see tangible outcomes and you get that through like metrics and telemetry. That doesn't happen in security, and I guarantee you a lot of vendors would be terrified by the idea that they have to be measured based on outcomes, and they come up with their own metrics that are very fancy and basically vanity metrics to try to justify spending on them. But if you look at tangible outcomes, a lot of time the evidence is pretty scarce, so I think it's a bit of a come-to-Jesus moment in a certain respect. If you start to go to this world where in DevOps it's more like outcome driven and you have to enable the business and you should be able to measure outcomes or you're trying to reduce things like time to response, security is just not there and it's kind of an existential threat. And I think it's more of an existential threat to the vendors, obviously to the practitioners. And I think that's why we see a lot of pushback. And I think why the term DevSecOps has been embraced rather than just trying to make sure that you fit within DevOps, because then or at least equally as important in this republic, like our name's still in there. So that's what matters, which I think is kind of silly personally. That's my hot take for the podcast is I think it's a very silly thing to do and very ego-driven. It's going to be a tough road to get there. I think honestly, we're going to continue to see some of the best improvements on the security side come from infrastructure tools. I think we've seen that, like even like I mentioned with CDNs, pretty much eradicated DDoS attacks. And that wasn't strictly a security tool. Like, if anything, that was more of a performance tool. And I think we're just going to see more of that. And that's my worry for InfoSec, is they're going to be so resistant that they're going to end up being left behind because they're going to dig in their heels, which I don't think anyone wants. But as far as what they could be doing more, it's listening. Honestly, a lot of it is listening, recognizing the commonalities, recognizing that we can't just keep existing without measuring our progress and our efficacy, and that we have to wisen up, and that DevOps does want to hear expertise. They just don't want to hear, no, you can't do that without justification. And because you say, well, because security, and don't give alternatives that still enable the business. Like, ultimately, businesses, for better or worse, are about making money. Security gets in the way of that. Guess who's going to win that fight? It's going to be the group that's making money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, definitely kind of very well phrased. How would you respond? Like, you mentioned a whole bunch of things about causes and what should vendors maybe sort of anticipate? If you're a consumer of security solutions, what would you change in your approach if you're a security team and you're still faced, like, the reality is the industry offers you a certain set of solutions? How do you adapt or change your perspective as you evaluate solutions?
Honestly, I think the biggest thing is focusing more on process rather than tech. I feel like in that people, process, technology triad, people ignore, at least in InfoSec, ignore the process part the most. Ultimately, DevOps is not a set of technologies, it's a set of practices, and that leads to processes. And I think InfoSec needs to look at those processes a lot closer and start adopting them. And I think we've tried to technology our way out of bad processes. We've tried to people our way out of bad processes, which is why you hear about the skill shortage all the time. And it hasn't worked. So I think if we're looking to move forward as an industry, we need to take a really close look at how we're actually conducting our security processes, starting to try to build those feedback loops. Frankly, a lot of it is a cultural change. I know culture is kind of seen as ho-hum in InfoSec because it's not technical or sexy, but there are really damaging things that come from, for instance, viewing human error as the cause of breaches and trying to resist failure rather than embrace it, because it means that your process is not going to be failure tolerant. And if failure is reality, then ultimately you aren't tolerant to, like, security failure. And to me, that's a job very poorly done. And with those kind of assumptions, you're going to focus on technology that tries to eradicate human error, which is just an impossibility evidenced in basically the whole course of human history. You're going to try to actually stop attacks and things like that, which I think we all know there's no tool that can actually stop all attacks. Nope. And I think there was interesting research out of IDC recently regarding, you know, the whole COVID situation, is that companies had focused so much on investing in technology, they'd never actually thought about processes. Just what if everyone has to work from home? Like, how do we make sure we have business continuity? I think that sort of stuff just won't fly in a DevOps sort of world. You have to be able to be flexible and adaptable to evolving situations, and InfoSec just isn't today.
Yeah. Oh, this is Kelly. I think every word is gold there. Like, I think very, very well said. I feel like I can kind of keep asking you questions here for a while, but I think we're probably kind of running out of time. I like to ask, I've already given a whole bunch of advice, but still I like to ask every guest on the show before we close off, if you have a team that's looking to kind of level up their security foo, what's the one bit of advice that you would give them, or they should start doing, or maybe they should stop doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's hard to boil it to just one, but I would say my perennial advice is always raise the cost of attack and be realistic about that. So don't focus on the Mossad level threat. Focus on what's realistic, which is like phishing and really basic sort of attacks, and figure out what simple interventions you can use to just cut off that low-hanging fruit for attackers, like two-factor being a great example. Start kind of with the basics. So think of it always as, how can we make this harder for the attacker? And I think that's kind of in some ways as simple as that. And if you anchor yourself to that and you start there, like, you won't be over-optimizing for things like blocking ODAY or all these side channel attacks or whatever else. Because that, until you're like really elite, that stuff just, you shouldn't bother for the most part.
Yeah, most of the time, the countries are after you. So
yeah, exactly.
Great advice. Kelly, this has been a pleasure. Thanks a lot for coming onto the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And thanks everybody for tuning in, and I hope you join us for the next one.
Thanks for listening to The Secure Developer. That's all we have time for today. For additional episodes and full transcriptions, visit mydevsecops.io. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or get involved in the community, you can also find us on Twitter at @mydevsecops. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes if you enjoyed today's episode. Bye for now.